The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for August 18th, 2016, the Should You Believe Juanita Broderick edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson of Face the Nation is here with me in Washington. Hello.
Hi, David.
Jean Valjean, fresh off his book tour, or in the middle of his book tour. The Whistle Stop Book Tour.
Oh my God! And a number of wonderful Slate Gabfest fans that have been on the Whistle Stop Book Tour. It's amazing. I've accepted so many compliments for you guys. It's just I should bring them in huge sacks of.
Read them on the floor of the Gabfest.
Exactly.
Also recipient of those compliments is of course Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, who is probably in New Haven. Are you in New Haven, Emily?
I am indeed. Welcome back, David.
Thank you. Yeah, I missed you guys. I didn't actually listen to the show, so I don't know whether it was great when I was gone, but I assume it was awesome. But I was too, it upset me too much. Plus, I had really crummy Wi-Fi. Was it good? It was good. It was good. Just say it. It was great.
It achieved new levels of greatness.
We missed you desperately.
On this week's Plots-Filled Gabfest, the shakeup of the Trump campaign. Amid reports that Trump's campaign guru, Paul Manafort, has even creepier ties to Russia than previously believed. Then the violence in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Donald Trump's response to it. Then the return of Juanita Broderick. How should Hillary Clinton supporters think about old allegations of sexual misbehavior by Bill Clinton? Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, the sale of Gawker and Peter Thiel's defense of his attempt to crush Gawker in court. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/GabFestPlus. The Trump campaign manufactured a whole new hailstorm of chaos this week amid reports that campaign chairman and string puller Paul Manafort had previously unrevealed and possibly illegal connections to Russian and Ukrainian power players. Trump shook up his campaign. He possibly demoted Manafort. We'll find out in a second whether he did. And he hired Breitbart News impresario Steve Bannon as his campaign CEO. He elevated pollster Kellyanne Conway to campaign manager. He may have enlisted Roger Ailes to coach him for his debate, or that may have already been going on. To discuss all this and more, we are joined by Slate contributing editor Frank Foer, who has written a ton about Manafort and his shady dealings. Frank,
hey, David.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
To the Gabfest.
Have you been on the show?
Crazy.
You've
never been on?
No, I'm a virgin.
Oh, my God. That's impossible.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm embarrassed.
Yeah, David,
good
for
friend.
This
way to go, David.
Shortcomings did I possess that you weren't telling me about, David?
Oh, my God. That's so embarrassing. And we were going to toss you out for Julia Yaffe anyway. When your time schedule, we were just like, get rid of him.
Okay, enough.
All right. So, Frank, can you just, like, for those of us who have not followed every twist of the Manafort story, what are the latest allegations against him and what do they pile onto? What is the huge steaming pile of Ukrainian dog shit that already exists there?
Well, to step back, for the last month of this campaign, people have been focused on the connections between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin and trying to explain this strange nexus between the two and all these mysterious things that seem to be happening, like the GOP platform shifting on Ukraine and his comments about NATO, et cetera. And so a lot of attention has focused on Paul Manafort because Manafort, in addition to being chairman of the campaign, has this long history of working in the Ukraine and working for several oligarchs in Ukraine and Russia. And so what we found this week was a set of black ledgers in a safe in the party
That's
of Regions
head. Not suspicious.
Never suspicious, especially not when $12.7 million in disbursements to you are written in Cyrillic chicken scratch. And so, we knew Paul Manafort was working for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the president of Ukraine and who brought Ukraine into Vladimir Putin's orbit. And we knew he got paid a lot of money for it, but we didn't know how much money. We didn't know where it came from. And here was seemingly concrete evidence that he got $12.7 million in this. I mean, even though it was in a book, it was really an off the book sort of payment. And we can assume that it's just a small chunk of the money that he got from the Ukrainians. And there's all sorts of other stuff swirling around Manafort on the side. So one of his business partners was a Ukrainian oligarch called Dmitry Firtash, who is Vladimir Putin's guy in Ukraine. Can I get a little bit into the weeds here? I won't get too much into the weeds.
That's a different podcast, but go ahead.
Okay. This guy, Firtash, would get sold natural gas by Putin at an extremely cheap rate. And then he would sell that cheap gas to the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians would pay full price. Now, the delta of the profit there, he took and he invested in trying to buy Ukraine on behalf of Putin, buy Ukraine's political class. And so this guy Firtash right now is we're trying to extradite him to the United States. And Firtash worked with Manafort on various projects. They tried to buy a building in New York, and Firtash basically laundered money through Manafort. And this stuff is kind of percolating on the side. So if you're Donald Trump and you're sitting and watching a lot of this stuff, you're frustrated with Paul Manafort because Manafort's telling you to behave in a way that seems very unnatural for Donald Trump. And there are probably a lot of people who hate Paul Manafort in the campaign who are pointing to each and every of these developments and telling Donald Trump that this guy is a scandal who's going to bring you down. And Trump doesn't like to act to head off potential scandals. He's got an incredible capacity for denying the evil of people around him. He does no vetting of the people that he hires, and he doesn't like to fire people. But it seems like there was this kind of anti-Manafort swarm that appealed to Trump in his gut that did the guy in ultimately.
John, so Frank just mentioned that one of the things that Manafort was trying to do was make Trump behave in ways that were counter to Trump's natural instincts. What is it that Manafort was trying to do on the campaign that was anathema to Trump? And is the shift to Bannon and Conway a reversion to Trump, letting Trump go his own way?
Yeah, letting Trump be Trump. What Manafort had been doing, and it wasn't just Manafort, but what those who are on the kind of outer, let's say the second ring outside of Trump and his family, and then the second ring beyond that, were people trying to create a bridge between Donald Trump of the primaries and Donald Trump of the general election. And so right after Manafort came in, he had a meeting with the Republican National Committee in which he said, you know, Donald Trump's been playing a role in the primaries. He's going to get more moderate and more agreeable in the general election. And so don't worry about what you might have seen with him in the primaries. He's going to pivot or modify. Trump himself said at various different times, you know, I can be more presidential than anyone else. I'll modify when and if the time comes and it's necessary. And so for the last several months, you've heard both Paul Manafort say this. You've heard Senator Bob Corker say that the private Trump is different than the public one. So everybody just gets need to know the private Trump. Dr. Ben Carson said there are two Trumps. There's this private guy. Governor Pence has been telling people, like Senator Jeff Flake, who has been a real critic of Trump's, you know, you don't really know the private Trump, who's very different than this public guy. So there's been this idea that he is going to modify, and that even if it doesn't look like he's modified yet, don't worry, there is this private Donald Trump who's quite different than this public. Donald Trump has finally just said, oh, stop it. There's one Trump. It's me. I won the primaries. Get out of my way. I'm going to do it that way in the general election. And that's what has happened kind of into the large structural sense of the campaign. The reasons he didn't like what Manafort was trying to help him do was, A, he doesn't want to – he wants to be Trump. He wants to be himself. He thinks that both is what is politically successful, and it's also much more pleasing than having to kind of wear the itchy shirt of the kind of general election Donald Trump that they were trying to create, which is not authentic. Secondly, there's been some grumbling when Manafort said on TV, you know, Donald Trump runs the campaign. I just execute this and that and the other thing. And the way that was received, or at least Manafort's enemies make this case, that was received as, hey, not my fault if this doesn't work well. Then there are all these distracting stories that come along about his personal relationships. There's a lot of grumbling in internal Trump land about lack of a ground game, which there isn't really one of to speak of. So there are a lot of troubles. And what he's done is hired, or essentially elevated, people who are likely to let him go his own way, continue being the guy he wants to be. And Manafort will still be a part of this, but certainly not in the same way he was before.
Before we get to the sort of Breitbart angle on it, let's just linger on Manafort, because he is a Dickensian kind of character. Frank, do you think that Trump's positions on Russia are in fact that he's being puppet mastered by Manafort? Do you think the fact that Manafort is close to Putin and the fact that Trump is appearing to represent Putin's interests in his campaign, that is a direct relationship, or those two things are happenstance?
They're happenstance. Trump was praising Vladimir Putin going back to 2007, long before he was getting handled by Paul Manafort. And, you know, my theory has always been that Trump had mercantilist reasons for praising Putin, that he wanted to build buildings in Russia, and sucking up to political power was extremely helpful for him there.
Manafort may have broken a series of laws. It's possible he broke a series of laws about sort of reporting as a foreign agent or doing the bidding of foreign governments while intervening in U.S. politics. Is that something that actually should be pursued by prosecutors? Is that a big deal? Or is this just sort of political gamesmanship and we should just let it be, let Manafort be a casualty of the campaign and not worry about this as a legal matter?
Well, the Clinton campaign has made a lot about the relationship between Donald Trump and Russia. I mean, it is striking that the previous Republican nominee said that Russia was the greatest geopolitical threat in the United – or sorry, to the United States. And now the guy who comes along after him, who has promised to be tough on all kinds of countries, what he says about China is a real departure from U.S. policy. And yet about Russia, he has this kind of very relaxed kind of, yeah, well, it's, you know, like totally in repose about Russia. So that's something the Clinton people made a lot about. They haven't in my – in the last couple of weeks made a lot about the Manafort connection, and maybe I've missed that, but B, it could also be because the Clinton Foundation's relationship with the State Department and the big money that was given to the Clinton Foundation and then the emails back and forth between the State Department and wealthy Lebanese billionaire types is in the same, I'm not saying it's of the same order, but it's in the same basket, and perhaps that may be why.
Similarly, there was yesterday the AP reported that there was a chunk of money that Manafort was funneling to the Podesta Group, which is run by Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's brother, Tony.
Right.
But on the technical question of whether he broke the law, the problem is that the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is the law that governs this, is something that is just not taken very seriously, hardly ever enforced, and was written and amended and interpreted in ways in which makes it very easy for somebody to represent a foreign government or foreign presidential candidate, give strategy and advice, and not be in technical violation of the law.
Let us move to the elevation of Steve Bannon, or the emergence in the Trump campaign, official emergence in the Trump campaign of Steve Bannon, now the CEO of the campaign. Bannon is, I confess, I knew nothing about till 3 days ago, is a fascinating figure. He's kind of a merry prankster of the right, maybe not so merry, just a prankster of the right who succeeded in running Breitbart News after Andrew Breitbart's death and has revived it and made it a kind of tribune of what people call the alt-right, of the nativist, populist, furious anti-immigration, white, mostly white right that Donald Trump is channeling. It has been a mouthpiece for that campaign. Now it is becoming, in some sense, an official arm of that campaign. So, John, did you know anything about Bannon? Had he been a presence in the campaign coverage before this news broke?
Well, yeah, because there have been a series of as Breitbart has picked sides in the Trump versus conservatives battle. There have been a number of people who worked at Breitbart, who now have left, or a number of people who are conservatives who've been targeted by Breitbart for one reason or another. And so he's been in the conversation for a while. And Ben Shapiro, who wrote for Breitbart, has been in the kind of public war with him. And the idea was basically that Breitbart had become the Pravda of the Trump campaign, although, as the Wall Street Journal put it today, Pravda was more subtle. There has been this war going on, and it gets really vicious really fast because Breitbart plays hardball. And so now there's a lot of people writing about Bannon in highly unflattering terms, who are from, in most other battles, would be considered to be his allies, at least ideologically.
Emily, do you think, as somebody watching the campaign, or somebody who's sort of fearful of a Trump presidency, which I think you are, that the arrival of this, you know, really effective P.T. Barnum-like right-wing propagandist and spectacle creator makes you think, oh my God, now the Trump campaign, you know, this represents a new danger to the Trump campaign? Or do you breathe a sigh of relief that, like, well, at least we know they're not going to have a ground game. At least we know that's just going to be sort of crazy flame throwing from here on out, and they're not going to they've given up on the idea of running a traditional campaign of the sort that could actually win the presidency.
I mean, it does seem like the latter is true, except that one wonders, you know, whether they will also pull out some investigation of the Clintons that will be new and change the dynamic of the campaign. I mean, one of Bannon's accomplishments is that Clinton Cash book that had a lot of just amazing investigative reporting in it that, you know, the New York Times, other major media outlets picked up. And his, as I understand it, one of his main really effective strategies is to help investigative reporters dig for stuff that is real news. I have to say, though, the fact that Bannon and Roger Ailes are showing up at the Trump campaign in the same moment makes me wonder if Plan B is like a new TV network, or if there is sort of another more kind of about Trump's brand and Trump's future in the media that's also the groundwork could be getting laid for that, too. Does that seem plausible to anybody?
It does to me, only because somebody I talked to who was explaining Trump's thinking about this basically said if he's going to lose, he's going to lose on his own terms, and that he so that there is a notion of who he is absent or separate and apart from the campaign. And by the way, if people are talking like that in 1964, there's a period where Barry Goldwater basically says to his advisors, stop it. I'm going to lose, but I'm going to lose my way, so that he retains some essential sense of himself. If that is, in fact, the way Trump is going, then that essential sense of himself and the greater crusade and the larger project continues on beyond the campaign. And so one of the most effective ways to do that would be to have your own campaign, your own media environment. Except, wouldn't that then, maybe in the same, and this is, I'm way out of my depth here, but in the way that Current TV was Al Gore's channel, like, isn't Trump's, what gives him currency is that he's in the mainstream media as well. And that if he created his own channel, he would kind of be in that kind of rut and stuck in there in a way that would probably make him less effective than.
But what do you mean effective?
Well, I mean,
that implies that he has some goal.
Yeah.
Well, his goal is to promote himself as a vehicle for his own views of the world. So
I think makes sense. It's like Glenn Beck going off into like some other universe, right? That then he ceases to be as much a part of the mainstream media.
But Trump thinks about a couple things. He thinks about ratings. And in fact, that is the view through which he – the lens through which he views this entire election. And I thought it was striking that, you know, one of the ways in which Kellyanne Conway, his new campaign manager, is able to talk to him is that she treats polls exactly as if they were TV ratings. And so I think in Trump's world, making money and getting a lot of viewers are winning. And I don't think that he especially cares about leading an ideological movement forward.
Can you imagine if Barry Goldwater had started a TV network in 1964? What would that have been like?
It would definitely be a whistle stop episode.
Yeah. It would be a very boring.
It would be so boring. It would have been really boring.
Although it turns out Barry Goldwater did some very exciting things. His planes that he flew were, you know, he had emergency landings. He was when he was years old on the 4th of July, he took his mother's revolver from under her pillow and shot the ceiling. So, you know, he was an exciting guy.
Just to step back and just to look at what this is making the Republican Party. So the wing of conservatism that Bannon represents, that this kind of atavistic, nationalistic, not especially libertarian wing of the Republican Party. This is all stuff that the Republicans tried to banish. It's lurked there even before. In a way, it's like the oldest type of conservatism. It's pre William F. Buckley conservatism. And every 5 years, Republicans fight a battle to try to banish this stuff because they know it's so toxic. And most Republicans don't agree with it. Yet it's managed to take over the whole operation.
Yeah, I mean, Bannon's allies include the V-Dare people, which are this sort of, I don't know how to describe it.
To slice the ideological salami, which is what I like doing. That sounded.
Go ahead, slice it.
Okay. I'm not just slicing. These are called the paleo conservatives. There's a wing of them. They have their own institutions, and they look with some nostalgia back at the Confederacy. Immigration and racial purity are obsessions of theirs. And Breitbart and Bannon are kind of the more acceptable versions of it. But this is a real thing with institutional structure and a strong point of view.
Right. Also, when you the nostalgia implies a kind of sepia toned, you know, gentleness to it, which there's none of that in this crowd. It's not simply a nostalgic. It's atavistic in a very nasty way. It's looking back to a time in the past, which is better, but it also is filled with animus towards Muslims, towards immigrants. It has a kind of hatefulness to it that nostalgia is the wrong word to embody.
The battle within the Republican Party that has already been underway with Breitbart calling out Paul Ryan. They were advocates for Ryan's opponent in his primary, which he won by, I think, about 85% of the vote. The elevation of this force within the Trump campaign will exacerbate those fights. And so it's now even more a moment of choosing for people like Ryan and McConnell because – you know, if you imagine that Manafort and the selection of Mike Pence were governors on Trump's instincts, those governors appear to be disappearing. And the things that Trump might do between now and Election Day, if feeding into this more aggressive posture, may leave indelible marks.
What can the party do? So Ryan and McConnell can sort of not say anything nice about Trump. But what literally can the party do?
They can't do much because this notion that the party would write Trump off doesn't work because Trump is raising all this money for the party. And as somebody involved in all of this said, it's like ordering a big fancy meal at a steak restaurant and then kicking the rich guy out. You still have to pay for it. They still need the money that he helps raise. So they can't say we're going to cut Donald Trump loose and just support the Senate and House candidates because they need his money to support the Senate and House candidates. And secondly, politically, that's real hard to do, is to tell people to become split ticket voters again after people have largely moved away from the split ticket voting. And if you're going to do that, you need the organs of the movement to be all singing in concert to disseminate the news. But obviously, the organs of the movement are at war with each other. You've got Sean Hannity and Breitbart on the kind of Trump side, and then you've got various other people not on the Trump side. So the message gets muddled.
A couple of quick things to wrap up here. Emily, should the Clinton campaign credential reporters from Breitbart?
Yeah. I mean, they should always credential reporters from everywhere, right? We shouldn't decide that a news organization ahead of time can't be covering the campaign. Is the idea that they're so gonzo and stunt-like in their tactics that they are
well,
just
no,
beyond
the idea
pale
is that they're or, the person who runs it is now the chairman of the opposing campaign.
Yeah, but maybe I just haven't really thought that through. I don't know. It just seems like they're a separate news organization. Do you think they shouldn't credential them?
I think there's a pretty good case not to credential them.
But they don't kick out trackers from the other campaigns, right? Right. So if you let a guy from the Republican Party sit there and videotape you, who cares if you let a guy from Breitbart sit there and record you?
Right, right.
Yeah, I guess so, I just think not credentialing, it's so petty and so Donald Trump right now to try to wave that power around. I hope the Clintons don't stoop that low.
And last thing on this. So Ailes is ostensibly coaching Trump for the debates. I can't imagine that Donald Trump is coachable. What is it that you think, Frank, that Ailes is doing? Or what could Ailes do for Trump that would be useful to Trump?
Ailes can feed him lines. And I think that Trump is largely an improvisational candidate. But I think that if he has a good one-liner in him, he would uncork it. I think that there are theatrics that, you know, Trump is a television guy, and like, we shouldn't assume that everything that he does is spontaneous and comes from his gut and is completely instinctual. He's been coached to become a persona that is like in some ways an authentic persona, but also is a constructed one. And so Ailes is going to tell him what to do with his face and how to gesture and how to hold himself and tell him some potential pitfalls about dealing with Hillary Clinton. I don't think it's all terribly meaningful in the end, but it could be marginally useful.
Frank Foer, Slate contributing editor. Thanks for guesting, Frank. We'll have you in for a whole show one of these days.
I you know what? This is such a happy occasion for me. I found such peace being here. So thank you.
Thanks, dude.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret,
and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
The shooting of Seville Smith in Milwaukee last weekend prompted rioting, arson, and also peaceful protests about the death of another African-American man at the hands of the police. Smith's death remains mysterious. He was carrying a gun, apparently, when he was shot and killed. It's not really clear what happened or why. But it certainly released a dismay and anger about what has been going on in Milwaukee, about the relationship between the police and the community in Milwaukee, and of course highlighted that highlighted that again as an issue for the nation as a whole. It also highlighted the quite grim segregation of Milwaukee, which is considered by many to be perhaps the worst place in America for African Americans to live. So, Emily, rather than starting with Smith's shooting, let's start with what is wrong in Milwaukee. What is it that has made it a place that so many people think is so bad for African Americans?
Well, Milwaukee has an entrenched and really striking pattern of residential segregation. And it's not the only city like this, right? I mean, we know where these dynamics come from, that after lots of African Americans migrated into northern cities, there were often discriminatory policies, you know, the government, the way that mortgage lending happened, there were these redlinings and these districts that were created, and it was very hard to combat that. And then you have white flight out of the kind of core of cities, leaving lots of African Americans and leaving them without easy access to jobs. So one of the big problems in Milwaukee that, you know, more recent government, especially Scott Walker, is partly responsible for, is not investing in public transportation that makes it easy for people who live in the city to get out of the city to the suburbs where the jobs, a lot of them now are. And this isn't specific to Milwaukee. I mean, Baltimore, other cities have similar histories, but it's become extremely pronounced in Milwaukee. And I'm sure some of our listeners read or heard about this book, Evicted, by Matthew Desmond, that was published last year and talked about eviction as essentially like akin to incarceration in its effect on Black families, kind of the equivalent for women in terms of how much they experience and how devastating it is in a way that incarceration can be for Black men. And that book is set in Milwaukee. And so when you're reading it, you're just reading about this incredibly segregated place in which a lot of Black people are really stuck, and the city has not been responsive to them. And so I do think there's this way in which the shooting was kind of the, you know, match lighting a big powder keg in the city.
Why do you think, John, that this shooting was one that prompted rioting and arson, which has largely been absent after these other shootings? I mean, certainly the Ferguson, there was civil unrest. But for the most part, the protests that have followed the killing of African-American Black cops have been very peaceful. Why did this one sort of
have
so much more rage?
So the preconditions were there that Emily described. I think you also, in 2014, you also had a shooting in Milwaukee, the murder of Dontre Hamilton by a police officer who was fired, but then ended up there was no... It wasn't charged. So it had the existing kind of feeling of no justice for these kinds of acts and things that take place. We're in a moment where this is now a national, I mean, the world is watching, or the country is watching each of these incidents. And so that must play some role, which is not only responding to local forces, but like that there is a greater injustice here than just what's happening in Milwaukee.
There's an interesting local law enforcement dynamic. The Black sheriff of Milwaukee County, who spoke at the Republican National Convention, David Clark, he's there. He gets elected by the whole county, which means that he gets more Republican voters in his election, more white voters than a city election would have. The city has a Democratic mayor. It has a district attorney named John Chisholm, who's pretty well known as a reformer among DAs. He's been trying to address racial disparity in low-level marijuana arrests and other kind of misdemeanor violations. But Clark, who is African-American but is deeply conservative, blamed, you know, sort of tribal, I can't remember what the second word he used was, but he wrote, I think, an op-ed this week where he talked about the inner city in Milwaukee as a jungle. So he's using these very racialized tropes to talk about this as like a place of hopelessness, and then he wanted to call National Guard. There's like these kinds of extreme conservative dynamics being injected into this discussion too.
And I think in the campaign context, this is turned into a conversation about law and order on the Trump side and about the police. Trump had a rally not in Milwaukee, in a heavily white Republican district, in which this was framed as on the one hand, put forward as his speech to the African American community, but it was essentially a celebration of the police, an argument that Hillary Clinton always blames the police. And the pitch to the African American community was essentially, she's a bigot because she takes you for granted. What that speech didn't really wrestle with, and what we also, I think, don't wrestle with as much are these underlying factors that in the presidential campaign, the bigger problem here is the fact, 15% of the or 16% of the kids who come out of Milwaukee City, African-American kids who come out of Milwaukee schools can read, and only about 20% are proficient in math, and that 3 in 4 black students attend schools that are 90% black, and that the population that can get loans is close to 20%, and it's only 4% in the African-American areas get loans. So there are these bigger problems that are out there requiring some kind of attention and solution, and they all get ignored, and it becomes a blacks versus the police conversation.
Yeah, that's really true.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
A fascinating and troubling story resurfaced this week. BuzzFeed ran a long profile of Juanita Broderick. You can be forgiven for forgetting who Juanita Broderick is. There were so many disturbing stories about Bill Clinton back in the day, and it came very late in the Bill Clinton sexual misbehavior cycle, which is why it never, I think, broke through in the way that Monica Lewinsky or Paula Jones's stories did. The story that Broderick has told for many years is that in 1978, when she was working in a nursing home, she was meeting with Clinton, who was then the governor, or was he the attorney general of Arkansas. He invited wanted to have a meeting with her, and then said he rescheduled the meeting for his hotel room so he didn't have to deal with the media. She claims that when she went to his room, he bit her lip and raped her. She told her friends at the time. She also says that Hillary Clinton made a veiled comment to her that she perceived as a threat. This story came out.
Which was what? Because I feel like that's an important part of the story, right?
Do you remember really the exact line?
I think she saw Hillary Clinton at a public event, and Hillary Clinton shook her hand and said, "Thank you very much for your help."
Right.
And she and Broderick interpreted that as intimidation in the context of her experience.
Right. This story surfaced only publicly 21 years later, after Clinton's impeachment was over, essentially, in an interview with NBC, after Clinton had already been not removed from office after the Senate trial. NBC ran this story. The Broderick allegations were considered by Ken Starr in his investigation of Clinton, but were not really incorporated into any of the testimony or the actual impeachment trial. BuzzFeed's story was weird in that, in a sense, it was couched in this Juanita Broderick has become anti-Clinton and has aligned herself with the right, being used in a Trump ad. BuzzFeed also points out that Clinton, in the wake of the Broderick allegations resurfacing, has in fact changed her own rhetoric and her campaign website's comments about rape. She had a line up saying that victims have a right to be believed, and that is now gone. It only says that victims have a right to be heard. One of the things this made me do is go back and just sort of refresh my memory of all of the allegations against Bill Clinton. And man, It is when you sort of pile it all up. Well, there's Jennifer Flowers, with whom he apparently had some kind of consensual affair, possibly. There's right. Paula Jones, who accused him of a form of sexual assault in a hotel room when she was a relatively low-level Arkansas state employee. There's Monica Lewinsky, who, again, that was consensual, but, you know, Monica Lewinsky was really young, and the behavior was really gross, and he was her boss.
For sure, a power abuse.
Yeah. And then Kathleen Willey, who was a donor, I think,
yeah.
and who made extremely credible allegations of sexual assault by him in the Oval Office, I think.
Right. Kathleen Willey was a White House volunteer aide. Something that put her in contact with him in more than one situation.
And then you have Broderick, who alleges rape. So I don't really have a question. It is just pretty astonishing when you pile up the allegations against Clinton and Bill Clinton and start to think about what that means.
And this is not, by the way, these are the ones that are on the record, then you have to add all the things that have been whispered about for so long.
Right. It's hard to imagine someone like Bill Clinton acting this now and getting away with it. Presumably, the women to whom these things happened would have had an easier time coming forward, finding reputable outlets to tell their stories in. There would have been a more immediate reaction. And so one of the things that's difficult about this is we're looking back. I mean, in Broderick's case, we're looking back, what, almost 40 years?
Yeah.
And in other cases, more like 30 or 20 years, and trying to decide how to think about these allegations now, knowing that they weren't taken seriously enough at the time. And that we have this question not really about whether to judge Bill Clinton, or at least for me, it's extremely easy to judge Bill Clinton over all of this. It's what do we do about how does this change how we think about Hillary Clinton, and in particular, whether she should be president in a race against Donald Trump, right? And so I feel like one of the hardest things about this for feminists is that the choice is so stark. It's, does Juanita Broderick's story disqualify from the presidency the first woman who is running for it against someone who many feminists, including me, desperately do not want to have become president? And in the starkness of that choice gets lost the real discussion about what actually happened to these women. What should we say to Juanita Broderick now, who's telling what seems to be, to me, a credible story about Bill Clinton that she's been pretty consistent about for a while? I understand completely why she didn't come forward earlier. But her story about Hillary Clinton, in her view, intimidating her, has never made a lot of sense to me. And so that part of it, I don't especially want to decide, you know, not to support Hillary Clinton because of Broderick's interpretation of their interaction. So to me, the BuzzFeed framing, I thought that Katie Baker, the writer of that story, first of all, did a really good job of both presenting Broderick's story with sensitivity, but then having some critical distance about the political, you know, Broderick wants to be believed. And so for her, the Trump folks are a real form of solace. But she's also, like, you know, in bed with people who are real conspiracy theorists about the Clintons. And it's just so, there's so many dynamics swirling around in all of this. It's pretty complicated.
Well, I actually disagree with you about that Baker's. I thought the Baker story was very good, and I thought the interview was great, and I thought the description of the story was great, and the account of Broderick was really credible. But I actually thought the framing of it is that she's making bad political choices, or that she's hurting her credibility, was wrongheaded. I mean, Broderick is, she's a, if you believe her story, she is a rape victim. Her rapist has not only gone on to be president, but is lionized across the world. Never been held to account for it. What do you want her to do? She wants her story to be out. Like, who is she? Who should she talk to? And it doesn't seem to me that Broderick is doing it in a particularly grotesque way. She's not, like, you know, showing up at campaign rallies at every minute, right, holding a sign. She's very modestly and quietly sort of talking about this. And I don't read her behavior as I'm a political activist. The people who want to tell the story are people who are opponents of Hillary Clinton.
And her story is not getting the traction in the mainstream media the way other victims of rape. I mean, there have been celebrated instances in which the victims have come out and described what it's like, and the mainstream media has rushed around them. And in this case, that hasn't happened. So why wouldn't she go for another venue?
Right. I actually thought that came across pretty well in the BuzzFeed piece. But it is also true that the reason we're interested again in Juanita Broderick is that Hillary Clinton is running for president. Not because we're looking back and trying to decide what Bill Clinton's legacy could be, right? This isn't parallel to the Bill Cosby allegations in that sense. And so, yes, it is natural for Juanita Broderick to turn to people who are disposed to believe her and treat her story with dignity and respect and air it. But it is also true that the political implications that matter right now are what does this mean for Hillary Clinton's candidacy? And that's a different question that, you know, changes the equation for how you think about this story.
Right. I mean, I think it's a totally fascinating question. How responsible are you for your spouse's sins? It doesn't seem to me that certainly the threat that Broderick describes seems to me not to rise the level of Hillary Clinton being a co-conspirator with Bill Clinton. That was not persuasive to me at all. But what is it okay for you to do as a spouse when you have a husband who has misbehaved in the way that Bill Clinton has been described as misbehaving as?
Well, it depends which of the misbehaviors we're talking about and what we think Hillary did, right? So, I mean, for me, the Monica Lewinsky story is one in which the narrative I've told myself for years about it is one that's sympathetic to Hillary Clinton, where her husband cheated on her. She stood by him. I mean, it would have been fine with me if she'd gotten rid of him. And I really wonder whether she would be a more effective candidate now if she'd divorced him a long time ago. But I don't judge her for that. That's like a decision she made within her marriage. But whether she tried to help cover up the stories that Paula Jones and Catherine Willey, maybe Juanita Broderick, were telling, that's much more difficult, right? It's, do we see Hillary as an enabler of Bill Clinton's, not just infidelities, but sexual assaults in a way that would have harmed other women? Was she in a position where she was trying to shut them up or discredit them because she was protecting her husband's political career and eventually her own political career? Or is she the wronged wife whose, you know, husband was cheating on her and then she's not responsible for what happened to these women because she wasn't trying to help them, but she wasn't trying to hurt them either? To me, it's like that history is what matters here. And I'm just not sure what the actual truth is of what she did or didn't do. John, do you have a sense of that history?
No, I don't. I was just trying to think of what, like, so you're a voter out there. What's the presidential question here? What's the thing that you're
what
supposed
is it?
To ask?
Is it like
I think
her
the presidential
judgment?
Question is whether the Clintons have had to habituate themselves to a different standard because there are these run-ins that the president has had over the course of his career. When you become used to finding your own way around the rules, whether that becomes the way you do it in all course of things, or whether this is the messiness of marriages that is known only to the people involved in it, and that's where it begins and ends.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Let us go to cocktail chatter when you're sitting with Mr. Bazelon, Emily, thinking about the future.
A person who doesn't exist. My children are coming home from overnight camp this weekend, so I'm going to be talking to them. I'm really curious about the story unfolding of these American swimmers who claim to have been robbed at gunpoint by Brazilians who were claiming to be police officers and are now having their story cast into doubt. I'm not sure what to think about it, but what strikes me about it is that it is the rare moment in which men who have not been victims of sexual assault are being called into account for their storytelling and their actions after their allegations of a crime. So what's happening is that the Brazilians who were deeply wounded and insulted by these allegations are now saying that they think these swimmers are lying because they have surveillance footage of the swimmers coming back to the Olympic Village and kind of chatting and joking with each other soon after the incident allegedly took place. That seems implausible to the Brazilians. And then there's some factual inconsistencies in the way that the swimmers told their story about this alleged robbery. And it's just really interesting to watch this kind of picking at a story and doubt take place and have the people making the allegations be young white men who say that they were victims of a robbery as opposed to women. I'm just really interested in watching the next unfolding of it.
John, what is your chatter?
In keeping with your longstanding debate that you've that we've talked about, which is whether all of the rules that have made government better are actually making it worse. And along those lines, the Partnership for Public Service, which is helping both campaigns prepare for the White House in terms of orderly transition, when you talk to the people who do transitions, when you look at the calendar that happens to a new president, and this one will be faced with a tougher calendar than most because they're likely to be offering the first Supreme Court nominee unless Garland gets put in after the election. They'll be making a Supreme Court nominee choice, and that'll create instant – there will be no honeymoon. It's not clear there are honeymoons anywhere before, but if you're putting forward somebody for the Supreme Court right away, it's going to kill the honeymoon even faster. So the transition teams try and get – administrations kind of on their feet as fast as possible because there are so few days to get things done before there's even the possibility of a window opening. So anyway, this Partnership for Public Service has argued that the president should relax his rules about letting lobbyists work in the administration because it turns out you have to fill 4,000 jobs. And if you say lobbyists can't do it, you can't fill your jobs. Like the removal of earmarks that David makes a strong case for having undermined the actual creation of compromise through skid greasing, the rules against lobbyists have both created an underground fake kind of hiding or underground hiding of lobbying so that they can get past these rules or kept good people from being in government. Anyway, we'll have to see if the Obama administration changes its rules or if the next administration changes its rules about having lobbyists work.
My chatter is about a fantastic, fantastic book I read on vacation. It's called Underground Airlines. It's by Ben Winters, who also wrote the Last Policeman series, those of you who know that series. Underground Airlines is an alternative, it's set in an alternative America. It's a counterfactual history. It imagines that the Civil War never was fought for reasons that are learned about in the course of the book. As a result, here we are in modern America, and there are still four states where slavery is legal. Not only that, the Fugitive Slave Act is still in effect, and this
creepy.
The book is about a free African American who is a slave catcher in the North. And it's an incredibly good book. And it's I think I love sort of counterfactual sci-fi alterno history kinds of books, but they usually fall apart. They have a great premise and they usually fall apart. This is a book which has a fantastic premise and it is fully realized and it carries it out beautifully all the way to the end. I haven't been as pleased and delighted and sort of rushed through a book and disturbed by a book in a really long time. So I strongly recommend Underground Airlines by Ben Winters. And also every single member of my family who's old enough to read it in instant, and my brother's family as well. So it wasn't just me. It wasn't just me that loved it.
Sounds like it's sort of talking to the new Colson Whitehead book,
Colson Whitehead book, which is called Underground Railroad. Yes.
Which I'm reading, which has a kind of reimagining and which I think is terrific.
Underground Airlines, of course, it's sort of like they've taken the metaphor of the railroad, and because it's modern America, it's now the airline. Is the Whitehead book good?
Yeah, it's really good. And it's good because it's reimagining this history, right? I mean, not just so there's a real railroad that's the railroad. And I guess Underground Airlines is a further modernization of that. But also Whitehead takes different states and turns them into places where different creepy laws are in place affecting Black people. So, you know, one state, South Carolina, seems benevolent, but it's really the site of a giant medical experiment. And it's ahistorical in a way that sounds kind of like this book, too. Now I want to read both of them.
Yeah. You know, I was probably in my 30s before I realized that the Underground Railroad was not actually a railroad. So just for what
it's
worth.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of people, actually. Maybe not a lot. But I think
the look on John's face is good.
John's looking horrified.
I'm not at all. No. I'm thinking, I was trying to figure out what the definition of that place in your memory is when you think, when you could have believed something, not because you actually believed it, but because you just never thought about it. Like, you didn't literally think it was a railroad.
Well, I literally thought it was a railroad clearly to a certain age. And then there's probably a period where I didn't think about it. And then one day I realized, oh, wait, it probably wasn't a railroad. But it was that was very late in life.
Colson Whitehead, I was listening to an interview with him, and he, as a child, thought it was a real railroad. I think he figured it out before you did.
He's a smarter guy than
I am. But did anyone think it was actually under the ground?
Yes.
An actual railroad under the ground.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's farther
well,
than
Well, then you really should read Colson Whitehead's book. You'll be very satisfied.
I'm a pretty literal-minded person. If you haven't noticed, I'm like a very straightforward, practical, sort of literal person.
Plus, it would have been hidden that way, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
If it was overground, they would have seen
what a feat of engineering.
Yeah.
Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lickteig is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest, which has links to what we talked about today. And our Facebook page is facebook.com/GabFest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. And our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Please subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes. Leave a comment and rating while you're there. For Emily Bazelon and Don Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll be with you next week.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.